नमस्ते, गुड मॉर्निंग एवरीवन। कपल ऑफ अनाउंसमेंट्स बिफोर आई बिगिन। वन इज दैट माय न्यू बुक हार्ट टू हार्ट इज आउट नाउ। इट इज नॉट रियली अ बुक ऑन अद्वैता और द टीचिंग्स इन अ डायरेक्ट सेंस। इट इज अ बिट ऑफ अ यू कुड से एन अ डायरी ऑफ माई स्पिरिचुअल जर्नी कंप्राइजिंग ऑफ सेक्रेट प्लेसेस आई हैव विजिटेड ओवर द ईयर्स, सम एपिसोड्स दैट आई एनकाउंटर्ड एज अ स्पिरिचुअल बुक पब्लिशर विच हेल्ड डीप इनसाइट्स फॉर मी। And lastly, my own spiritual journey. So these are a kind of collection of essays. They are really not connected, so they don't have to be read in a linear fashion. They could be read even at random. And if this kind of a book appeals to you, then do get a copy. The other thing is, there have been many requests at the satsangs at home for those who are fluent only in the Hindi language, if they can ask questions in Hindi and if I could reply in Hindi. Most certainly, I will do that. So they are welcome to come and ask their questions in Hindi. And I'm sure if I get stuck in my reply, since I don't speak Hindi that fluently, there will be others to assist. And lastly, I look forward to seeing some of y'all at the 3-day retreat in Dharamshala, which begins on Friday. And diving deeply into these most precious teachings. Today, I would like to talk about the aspect of Maya, this world, this manifestation, and its relationship to the source. There was a quotation I read of an American film producer whose name I have forgotten. This is what he said. There are three sides to every story. My side, your side, and the truth. I think this one sentence contains within itself the living teaching of Advaita. Can this be lived? Now let us imagine an event or someone says something to us which triggers a reaction within us and we reply. Now, when we realize that our reaction is based on our filters, our conditioning, our genetics, which make up our nature, our reaction is influenced by this. Genetics and conditioning. It is evident that it is not the truth. Why? Because someone else in our position with a different set of conditioning, genetics, and a different inherent nature would perhaps not react the same way. It is my side of the story. my side of the story. In that sense, it is my truth, but it is not the truth. When we live this understanding, a degree of openness and humility sets in, which was not there before. Likewise, when we have this understanding that the person before us who has said what they've had to say is also not speaking the truth, because they are speaking whatever they are speaking based on their filters, their conditioning, their nature, their genetics, which God made, which is their side of the story. When this happens, when this realization is the operating force in our interactions, we find that a degree of impersonality sets in, which means we are no longer triggered as a person in that sense. We are not reacting as one individual reacting to another individual. That reaction, which is by and large our default setting, is based on the principle of doership. And Advaita seeks to pull out this thorn of doership. The ego deluded thinks, I am the doer. So each person, when two people are speaking, is acting as if their version is the truth. It is just their perception, their interpretation based on their life's experiences. Now that leaves us with the truth. And what is the truth? Can you imagine an event happening which you had nothing to do with? Absolutely nothing to do with that event. There would be no reaction. But because of the way we are made, we react. This does not change. What we are doing is exploring how this is designed, how we all are designed. What principles are we operating on? When something happens in our life, we are giving meaning to it. The event itself is an event. But based on our fears, anxieties, thought processes, conditioning, as I say, and so on and so forth, that event is interpreted by the mind, a story is built around it, and I start living this as my truth. This becomes encrusted and hardwired as the years go by. This is what one could call the darkness of the ego with its sense of doership. So the truth cannot be understood logically, rationally, and so on, because that is the thinking mind, which is trying to dissect and analyze the truth. And as my teacher would say, what is the truth? The truth is that which nobody can deny. then that is the truth. Nobody can deny it. And that truth is the impersonal awareness of being. The impersonal, which means, as he would say, if your memory was wiped out right now at the push of a button, you would not remember your name, your home, your parents, your children, the work, nothing. Blank slate. Yet, being is there, and you are aware of the being. The impersonal awareness of being, I am. That is the only truth which nobody can deny. Because the minute you deny it, you prove that you exist. So this impersonal awareness of being is right here, right now. One could say the baby, the child consciousness is established in this state of being. The ego, which is brought in by what my teacher would call an act of divine hypnosis. This ego starts developing by and by. And what was this impersonal awareness of being, which one could call pure joy, true happiness, is now layered with concepts that in turn are based on conditioning the child starts receiving and on which it develops a worldview, on which the foundations of fear are now based. I must protect myself from the other. I must save myself. No one should harm me. And so on and so forth. So the impersonal awareness of being the truth became a life burdened with doing, becoming, and so on. Burdensome life, a troubled life. Now, let's come to the subject of Maya, the illusion. Let's go a bit deeper into this. If all there is consciousness, if all there is the source, then one must admit that even the so-called illusion is part of the source. It cannot be apart from it. So the illusion cannot be rejected, you see. And that is why I prefer the translation of Maya to be appearance. Appearance, it appears because you see it. It is what Goldsmith would call the mirage. It is still there. Yet, it is worthless. It doesn't mean you don't see it. What happens is, in life, in daily living, we take the appearance as the truth. The manifestation is a reflection of the source within itself, not apart from it. What we see, the objects, what we see, hear, taste, smell, and touch, the manifestation as we know it, is a reflection of the source within itself, which means one could say it is equally part of the source. So how can one reject the manifestation in that sense and just be concerned with the source and staying connected to the source? The connection happens through life, through daily living, through the manifested world, through relationships. There is no relationship apart from God. There is nothing apart from God. And that is why when a sage like Sri Aurobindo would emphasize this fact that, you see, meditation is all right, it's just the inner journey, but how you deal with the outside world, how you relate with it, that too is an integral part of one's spiritual journey. Because one could then call it a holistic understanding of life. When one finds that one's relationships with people, with the events in one's life and with oneself are by and large on an even keel, and they don't disturb my harmony, my equilibrium, then I find I am resting in a peace, that same peace. Which is the impersonal awareness of being. That is why the sages have emphasized this point of peace. It is not about rejecting the manifest world, brushing it off as an illusion. What they are attempting to do is to make us not get mesmerized by the show, by the manifestation. Because when we are mesmerized by it, we get sucked into it. We take it to be the truth, and that creates suffering, unimaginable suffering. So, for example, Goldsmith used many words for this. He even used illusion in context. He used mesmerism, he used hypnosis. So, we tend to get hypnotized by the goings on in our lives. And this teaching says, hey, pull back. It appears to be that people are doing things to you. It appears to be that you are doing things. But there is only one primal doer behind it all. To rest in that knowing is where one finds one's peace. Peace cannot be found apart from your daily living. You may be peaceful in your meditation of 1 hour in the morning, and the other hours are deeply disturbed. What is the value of such peace? That is why my teacher Nisargadatta Maharaj would say, my teacher and Nisargadatta Maharaj, Ramesh Balsekar and Nisargadatta, peace cannot be found in the flow of life, but rather in one's attitude to life. So when we start living this understanding, whatever we may say to someone, no matter how good our intentions are, no matter how convinced we are of our point of view, that it is only one version. We make our load lighter because we are not identified strongly with what we say and what we think and what we do, because it is that identification, me, my point of view, my opinion, my judgment. It is that identification which causes a fair degree of psychological suffering. So I now find if I have to tell someone something, I express myself once and I let it be. Whether the person sees my point of view or not is God's will. When I meet people and interact with them and I see they have differing points of view, I understand now that they are fully entitled to their points of view. I would have the same point of view if I had their conditioning and their nature. So I'm no longer fighting these personal battles anymore like I used to. I know I have mentioned these two or three quotations a few times, but please bear with me. I know I harp on this simple point of peace. But I do feel it needs to be stressed because peace gets missed. Because it is not alluring and attractive. Something the ego can get hooked onto. Yet, we all know that we are most at peace in deep sleep, which is the absence of me and my story. Ramana Maharshi, that which results in peace is the highest perfection. That is all. This one sentence sums it all up. By no one less than Bhagwan. That which results in peace is the highest perfection, highest siddhi, you could call it. Nisargadatta Maharaj, in the book I Am That, someone says, we are told of the bliss of non-duality. And Maharaj replies, such bliss is more in the nature of a great peace, which means it is not of the nature of an experience of bliss, which of course has its own importance and relevance because it represents a paradigm shift away from the mundane, but it is of the nature of a great peace. Because after that experience, one finds that the manifest world is no longer as enthralling as it was before. This I have mentioned before as well from Peter Russell in his book Letting Go of Nothing. The Sanskrit word ananda stems from ananda, ananda. Nanda means contentment or satisfaction. The prefix a is used to denote strong emphasis. So, ananda means great contentment or great satisfaction. The great contentment that comes from returning to our own being. That is all. That child you were when you were just sitting, watching people, the scenery, the view outside the window, and just being happy in that, undisturbed, untouched by the traumas, the setbacks, views shaped, things that have happened. Resting in one's being is what gives great content. Like I mentioned in the talk at home last weekend, there is a manager who comes to my office once in a week to 10 days. Post-COVID, she has been working from home, so we catch up every now and then at office. And that day, I found her unduly distracted when we were sitting together going through various things. So I asked her, I said, "What is the matter? You're not present to what we are discussing." And she said, "Sir, that's because I'm very happy." I said, "Really? Is there some good news? Please share it." And she replied, saying, "The good news is that after a long time, there have been 2 or 3 days of peace at my home." Someone who has seen conflict in life, the greatest gift, if you ask them, what is the greatest gift God could give you? Their answer would be the absence of conflict, nothing else. That person would not want anything else, and that person is us. So, to sum this up, as Goldsmith would say, when we give up the belief in two powers, we are no longer mesmerized. The primary polarities in duality, one could say, as far as he was concerned, the polarities of good and evil. When we live this realization, there's no power apart from God, then we have risen above the primary polarity, which is what my teacher would say in his own words. Consciousness is all there is. There's nothing apart from it. Everyone is an instrument through whom God's will functions. So no individual has been bestowed power in that sense. When we see the hand of God operating through everyone, including myself, then my vision has healed back from a split vision of me versus the other to me and the other in this manifestation as we know it, living our daily lives. No longer mired in the attributes which normally emerge: hatred, malice, ill will, jealousy, envy, pride, arrogance, guilt, shame, and so on and so forth. This one could call enlightened living. You see, the natural way is the way of harmlessness. Sounds funny. Someone once asked Rameshji, "Wouldn't hate also be a part of consciousness?" And his answer was, "Yes, in the moment maybe, but if consciousness is all there is, can consciousness hate itself? Likewise, if consciousness is all there is, can consciousness love itself?" It can't, because the nature of consciousness is love. That is why they say that a master-student relationship, the guru-disciple relationship, is that of a transcendental love, a love that is not experienced in other relationships, which is dualistic love. Because the master-student, guru-disciple relationship is a reflection of our relationship with the source, which we are not apart from. And so Maharaj said, live your life without hurting anybody. Harmlessness is a most powerful form of yoga, and it will take you speedily to your goal. This is what I call Nisarga Yoga, the natural yoga. It is the art of living in peace and harmony, in friendliness and love. The fruit of it is happiness, which is uncaused and endless. So simple. Luckily, today I had all these at my disposal. Otherwise, I have to keep searching for them through my phone. All right. If anyone would like to ask anything, share anything, you are most welcome to now. Please make sure that your camera is not shaking too much, because it tends to be a distraction for me, and that the audio is clear and that your camera is on. Just give me a second to set this up. Yes, Meena.
Namaste, Gautam. I'm speaking from America, so just want to say namaste. And
namaste, Meena, one sec. For some reason, I can't see you, so just give me a sec, please.
Okay.
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. So namaste, and namaste to everyone here. It's such a pleasure to be here. Yeah. Anyways, I just want to say, like, I'm so just amazed by your teachings, and they've just been of so much incredible help to me. So I'm just so grateful for God's will that I discovered you and that we're having this conversation. So I just want to start off by saying that. And then my question here is, I've been following your teachings, and you know, one thing that I come across, I usually say is like, okay, you know, expecting somebody to change is like a form of violence, right? And like, you know, they're amazing. So the way, I guess what you're talking about is like, just accept people as they are, because that's part of God's creation. And, you know, that they're part of that. And basically our relationship with others is a reflection of our relationship with God. And I totally get that. And I've been trying to implement that in my daily living. The only sort of challenge I've been coming across in that teaching is that even if, like, on my end, I try to be accepting of others, unfortunately, we don't always get that response in return, right? So, you know, we try from our end, like, we're not trying to be violent, right? But unfortunately, other people can be quote unquote violent, right? Because they try to judge. Yeah, they try to judge us, or they try to blame us and do all kinds of things. So what do you say? Like, I think from what I gathered of your teachings, you always mention, like, do what's according to your nature, right? Do your dharma, or do you like follow your swabhav. So should I do that? Should I follow my swabhav? Or what's sort of the best, most conscious way? What would a sage do, right? So, like, how can I train myself to respond to those people that are committing that sort of violence towards me? Or this is a question for everyone. So,
well, Meena, it's really quite simple. Yes, we are only concerned with ourselves. We have no control over the other person. We cannot expect them to be a certain way, as you yourself had said. Now, in a given situation, in a given relationship, we have to do precisely that which we think and feel we should do. Which means that if we are in a toxic relationship, for example, we have to decide, do we want to continue dealing with this person, trying to convince this person, expressing ourselves constantly, or do we walk away? The decision is ours. This teaching of Advaita will not tell you what to do and what not to do. It says, do precisely that which you think and feel you should do. But make no mistake, this teaching is to only do with yourself. Any form of expectation, as you've so rightly said, what the tenets of the teaching are, is bound to lead in frustration. It's going to lead to frustration because we have absolutely no control over others. They will behave as per their blueprint, as per their script. Our peace is to be found within us, not through the other person changing or through us convincing the other person. If we are in an environment, we must decide, do I walk away from this environment if I have the choice? Or what are my other options? But one word of caution is, if I find in general my entire environment, relationships across the board are difficult, then it is something for me to look at. If it is an odd relationship here and there, understandable. But if I find that I'm not able to get along with most people in my life, whether at work, family, friends, so on and so forth, then it needs a deeper introspection.
Got it. Yeah.
I must share one very interesting thing which happened with me maybe a couple of years ago. I saw two people arguing, and one was playing the role of the aggressor and one was playing the role of the victim. That was going on. And in that instance, I found for myself that if certain emotions within me were heightened, I would perhaps be the aggressor like the aggressor was. And if certain emotions in me were kind of watered down even further, I would be the victim like the victim was. And I found that I was both in extremities. And I realized that everyone is operating on their scale. Some are very wired, some are very strong individuals, others are very mild. And they truly represent us, but in varying degrees. You know, because then what happens is we can relate to people because we feel it within ourselves, that there's nothing apart from us to be judged. And this happened for me. It was more in the moment of that encounter. And I said, wow, you know, that if certain kind of levers are pushed very up, people behave this way, and very down, people behave this way. And therefore, this saying, you know, that all relationships are a reflection of our relationship with ourselves. So by and by, in anyone's life, this is what I say. Do you find that by and large, your relationships are harmonious, equanimous, and barring a few, which we all have, which are the ones where our deepest learning is resting, are there to trouble us? Or do we find by and by we are not able to get along largely with the whole world? Then we really have to go within. So I'm not sure that answers your question, but peace is to be found through the relationships.
Got
Through
it.
the relationships. Does that help?
Yeah. No, of course. And then I'm sorry, just one more thing. I know because other people have their head on, but I really just want to ask just if within this topic, obviously in this whole thing that you just mentioned, which I totally grasped really well, and it totally made sense. And you also talked about something called Rinanubandhan, right? Which is sort of like karmic connections, right? Could be past life karmic connections. It could just, you know, just like that karmic connection you have with people. That obviously plays a role in how much peace we have, right? With other people, or if we don't have peace with other people, does that also sort of play a role?
No, all relationships are on account of Rinanubandhan. The peace is to be found when the teaching of non-doership is lived, that nobody is a doer of their actions. Then this rin, this debt, this bondage, bandhan, is broken. All relationships with your closest friends and the ones you have trouble who have troubled you the most are on account of Rinanu Bandhan. It is not that you have Rinanu Bandhan only with a few people. When you absolve a person of doership and you can see that this person is playing out their blueprint, their script in this game of life, they were meant to say and do certain things to you. And you no longer train your guns at an individual, then the bandhan is broken. Yet, Meena has to decide what to do. It doesn't mean she allows herself to be walked all over. Depending on her nature, she decides to take certain action. That continues. But Rinanu Bandhan is, as Yogananda would say, I think it was Yogananda, that we are all here on account of Rinanu Bandhan. Sai Baba said the same thing. The ones who are troubling you are perhaps doing you a favor because they are making an unconscious effort to make you see the one behind the many. Make you see who's behind this puppet show, or rather above. All right?
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Namaste. Pleasure.
Namaste. Yes, Finn.
Yes. Hello. Namaste.
Namaste.
Nice to meet you.
You too.
I have been thinking about the apparent contradiction between these kinds of Advaita teachings about non-doership and also the yogic teachings on karma. You have the prarabdha karma and the purushartha, the different types of karma. And I've been thinking about, like, is this... is one of them true, one of them not true? Can both be true at the same time? Are they pointing to different levels of this like dance of life, if you would call it like that? Do you have anything to share about that?
I haven't understood your question in relation to daily living.
No, not the You're saying, like, for instance, the yogic teachings on karma, you have the prarabdha karma, which is the active karma, and then you have the purushartha, which is the actions you take.
Yes.
And then this kind of Advaita teaching says there is no doer. And
yes.
So how does that make sense in relations to like this karmic teachings that there are some karmas that are active,
yes,
and
I
some
understand.
Karmas that,
So you see, it is absolutely correct. There are various types of karma. There's prarabdha karma, there's agami karma, sanchita karma, and so on and so forth. Advaita does not negate that. What the living teaching of Advaita points at is how we perpetuate this karma in daily living. This action reaction loop, it is perpetuated because of doership. And when this stops happening, this embroilment and conflict in life because of the blame game, finger pointing, and so on, karma, which represents action, which became my action and your action, is now relegated back to action, pure action. In that sense, when the sense of doership is imbibed and understood and this principle of not being the doer is lived, it is the end of that karma. Yet prarabdha is operating, otherwise we would not be alive here. But there's no perpetuation of that. This is a very important point. Advaita does not negate the karma theory. But this is most important. It's the pivot of the Bhagavad Gita. As I said before, the ego deluded thinks I am the doer. That is what is creating the karmic bondage. And when you release others from this bondage and yourself, then what action is meant to play out is allowed to play out without being perpetuated in this endless cycle of time. So one in that sense has stepped out of it. That is why when Bhagwan Ramana Maharshi was asked that in an enlightened sage, which of the karmas are left operating? And he replied that if a man is married to three wives and the man dies, all three become widows at the same time. So it is the end of karma in that sense. The exact quote of Bhagwan's you'll find on the internet. So a way of living is to understand dynamics, interhuman relationships, how they have been functioning in my life, all the hatred I've been carrying towards certain people who really disturbed me a lot. My loved ones love me, I'm very happy with them, and so on. Because when we see that consciousness is operating through everyone, as Ramakrishna Paramahansa said to a mother, that when you start loving all children as your own and not just your child, then you will know what it is to be enlightened. This can only happen when we see God as the one primal doer behind everyone. When that happens, I am released from the karmic bondages. They are no longer going to pull me in unconscious patterning, which I have been a victim of so far, if it is my destiny. So I am no expert on the karma theory, but this is truly my understanding. When I hold no one in my life responsible in that sense, I am free. When I can say on my last day on earth, thank you to God for showing me, making me learn lessons in life, teaching me that it, he or she was behind everyone and all events that transpired, then I know I am not carrying this burden any further. It has dropped with the death of the body. More importantly, when I'm alive, my mind space, when it is no longer filled with the junk and garbage of blame and hate and condemnation, I am present to what the next moment brings. That is the beauty of it. That vacant mind, that available mind, what one could call conscious presence, right here, right now, happens when one has understood the concept of non-doership.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Vikram. Sorry. Yeah.
Hi, Gautam. Thank you. अगर मैं हिंदी में पूछूं तो ठीक रहेगा अभी
We can try. कोशिश करते हैं मैं कोशिश करूंगा जवाब देने Actually, Zoom has more of an international audience, but we'll try. You can ask in Hindi, I'll reply and we'll translate it.
Let me ask in English itself then. So, no, I've been following your teaching and for Nisargadatta Maharaj for quite some time. And I think through you also see Ramesh ji in a different light now. So thank you for that. I think I'll go back to the topic of Maya, and you talked about how manifestation of the source is a reflection of the source within, and how your peace cannot be found apart from daily living. I think my challenge is that in my childhood, I've had lots of trauma, and because of which my conditioning and fear has been in a level where it affects my day-to-day interactions with people. And sometimes I find myself not being able to come to terms with these past happenings. So I've gone through some level of therapy for that too, but and the people who are there at that time, they have long left or I have no contact with them anymore. So I just feel like, how do you make, yes, there is a level of conditioning, there is a level of genes that are, but how do you make peace with what has happened in the past? Yes, you can live life differently going forward. Is therapy the right way? Is something around in Advaita that helps?
Did you say a lot of trauma in the past, in the childhood? Well, that's all of us, Vikram. I mentioned this at a talk about a conversation with a therapist in the US. She's related to me, and she said she's specializing in trauma. And I said, then you must have a very successful practice because we are all traumatized. Siddharameshwar Maharaj said the process of birth itself is so traumatic. That is why the baby comes out crying in most cases, you see. The point is, of course, therapy has its place. It makes us understand where we are coming from. And if it helps you, you must continue with it. The point of Advaita is what, Vikram? Nothing can be undone if it was part of your destiny. Of course, the trauma is going to shape your worldviews. That is what conditioning does. There's no attempt here to undo anything. This teaching is like a balm. This teaching is like a soothing gel, which says that in your traumatic past, whatever happened, A, was your destiny. B, nobody was the doer of their actions. It cannot undo your feelings. Please don't look for that. It's not going to happen because those are part of your cellular memory now. But by and by, what this teaching does is it frees you from being trapped in the past where you hated people for doing things to you and you got stuck and started living there. That is what it does. It frees you of them. It absolves them as far as your understanding is concerned. When the memory comes up, which it may, of course, pain will arise. But that pain will now not be followed by psychological suffering like it used to earlier, because a large part of that psychological suffering, that was the sound of a car reversing. A large part of that psychological suffering was invested in this blame game, this hatred of their actions, the other's actions. That starts dropping away with the fresh conditioning, which is imbued by this teaching, which starts seeping into the bloodstream. More importantly, as I go through the rest of my life, living the teaching, it brings me a sense of peace and equilibrium, which I didn't have before. That is what happens. That is what happens. That is why I use the example often when the Lord came to Prahlad and said, I'll grant you a boon. And he said, my Lord, I don't want this young boy. He said, I don't want your boons. The fact you've appeared before me is enough. And the Lord insisted. He said, all right, since you're insisting, I want that no harm should come to those who have tortured me. And the Lord was perplexed. Really? And Prahlad replied, yes, my Lord, because to wish harm upon them would mean to wish harm upon you because you created them. So, this obsession with getting back at people, tit for tat, revenge, harming them because they did this to me, so on and so forth, all that starts dissolving in the light and clarity of the understanding. That is what happens. All right.
Thank you.
You have an interesting bookshelf behind you. Is that, are those Lonely Planets behind you?
Yes, they are lonely planets, and I was doing some yoga teaching course. I've got lots of Advaita philosophy books also. I've got one of your books too, the one and yeah, and Ramesh's and yeah, a few of them.
Do you know that I read in my advertising days, Lonely Planet was such a success, but the original name for it was Lovely Planet, and because of a typography error, it became Lonely Planet. And see what a big hit that was.
Never
It's
knew that.
amazing. It's amazing. And that rocket kind of reminds me of a rocket I had seen in a Tintin comic when I was
It is
young. It is.
exactly it is a Tintin rocket from the Explorers of the Moon. I'm a big
Oh,
Tintin.
yes, that's right. That's the one. Amazing. Okay. All the best to you, Vikram.
Thank you, Gautam.
Yes, Tripura.
Thank you. I came across you, I think it was a cosmic intervention in my case. I was going through a lot of confusion, and one night, I never dream. I never remember. I mean, I probably dream, but I never remember my dreams. When I woke up, I remembered your name. And I knew your name when I woke up, and you showed up on my YouTube feed. That's how I started watching your talks about a few months ago. And it has brought a lot of clarity to me in some things. But as clarity comes, there is confusion as well. There is duality in it. So what I don't understand is, what is the meaning of this life if there is nothing that you do, but you're playing as somebody else? I mean, the source is pawn in many senses. You walk away from any situation not taking an imprint of that situation, whether you acted well or you did not act well, then what is the purpose? Life feels meaningless when you think about it. And then when it blurs out, when the confu when you, when I forget about this, then you're in the chaos of life. And when the clarity sets in, you feel life is very meaningless. It's very
Yes.
difficult to live, or I'm not able to understand how to cross that. The confusion I was having before that was, I was doing some yoga. I've been doing meditation and yoga for about 2, 1.5 years now. And I started getting emotional when I'm in my regular activities. I feel I'm moving away from my family. I have a feeling I'm withdrawing myself, and that brings a lot of emotion because I have to let go. On one side, I feel I should let go because I'm going to find a lot of peace, but I'm not able to let go, and there's so much emotion. So it's a lot of confusion like that, and I cannot understand why and how to get past
Sure.
that.
See, Tripura, this is a classic scenario. Many on the spiritual path go through what you are going through because you see, the meaning of life gets redefined as life goes on. What we felt had meaning no longer has meaning. The meaning we derived from the mundane world is now, life has taught us it's really not that precious. That is what is the process you're going through. That is why my teacher would say, you know, that is the turning point. Thus was a seeker born. So, to simplify it, he would say that really, if we keep it simple, that the purpose of life is the living of it. That's all. The purpose of life is the living of it in peace and harmony, rather than a goal-oriented purpose, day by day, event by event. Conversation by conversation, and realizing that this is a transient show, this too shall pass. Whatever happens is the will of God. This recalibration brings us to a center where we are no longer buffeted by the winds of pleasure and pain like we used to be earlier. So one could call this, and in this process, one could call this the purpose of life, the meaning of life, to just simplify it. Otherwise, like Bhagwan said, what else is this life for except self-realization? But to simplify it, bring it down to daily living, something we can all understand. This is going to happen because even with family, with your closest friends, there's going to be this push-pull, this tug of war. It is a natural process. So my suggestion is not to get disheartened by it. This is the ego going through this kind of transition period where it's realized that the peace I'm looking for is within me, not through an outcome of a relationship, an event, a family member, or this or that. That is why you are feeling this, what also we call the flip-flop. Sometimes a lot of peace, sometimes conflict. Sometimes peace, sometimes conflict. That is what tends to happen. Because you see, if this had not happened, this recalibration or this new understanding seeping in, one would have lived unconscious patterns all one's life. At least the grace is there that something has stepped in. It's like a wake-up call. It's, hey, like, let's see life through another dimension, another way, with a new light. And that is bound to cause disturbance, Tripura. So it is a part of the process and it needs to be witnessed. Easier said than done, I know. But as my teacher would say, that if God has brought you here so far, why would you think that he would drop you here? All right? Okay.
Okay.
Yes, Sarthak. The writer.
Guilty as charged. Namaste, Gautam. Namaste. First of all, I would like to congratulate you for the new book that just dropped, Heart to Heart. Excited to read it.
Thank you.
So my question today is, what happens after, let me rephrase this. Once awakening happens in daily living, how does the relationship between the disciple and the master, which is essentially the same thing, that transcendental love, how does that translate into daily living, or how does it transform? How does it feel like?
I haven't got your question, Sarthak. In how is a relationship with reference to the relationship? What is the context with daily living?
Let's say, for instance, if you were using a human form or just a non-animate, non-human form as the guru, right? Now, since the separation has dropped, how does that relationship translate into daily living? You know what I mean? Like,
as far as that relationship is concerned, you could call it true love. Like between Vivekananda and Ramakrishna. But in daily living, how does it translate is in living the teaching. In deliverance, awakening is the beginning. Deliverance is living the teachings day by day. That is what happens. I still don't know if that has answered your question, but
it's definitely narrowed okay. My question.
Let me put it this way. You go to a teacher. You're deeply
from awakening to deliverance, what is that journey like?
That is exactly what I'm coming to. That journey can be smooth or can be rough. But the difference is, you go to a master, he says something, or he doesn't have to say, it's his silence, something touches you. You feel awakened to a new way of being which you were not exposed to before. That is awakening. Something has shifted, maybe you can put your finger on it, maybe you can't. That is it, you're awakening out of the living dream of life. That happens, right? But you still have problems. You still have relationships, conflicts. You can't figure out why God is mean to you and happy with you sometimes and so on. By and by, it's like you're driving your car through heavy traffic. So a driving license does not make you peaceful immediately. You're still going to be scared driving on the road because you're new. You've just got your driver's license. But after 2 or 3 years, that one road which used to scare you, you realize I've been driving down this road for the last 6 months with the least stress. At that point, you know you have been delivered. What is deliverance? Awakening, functioning in daily living is deliverance. That is the difference. Awakening on its own does not mean Sarthak will be able to drive through heavy traffic with the least mental stress. It is the starting point. But that deliverance is when Sarthak knows that these teachings which struck my heart have been lived by me and are being lived by me day by day. That is the very big difference.
That's how the cookie crumbles.
Yes. Can we just hold on for 2 minutes? I need to plug in my charger and we will take perhaps just one last question. So please give me 2 minutes. Yes. Okay, Rahul.
Guruji, am I audible?
Yes.
Namaste, Guruji. Thank you for your talk. I had few doubts which I'm facing for few days when I'm reading and thinking about our understanding in the books. So one of the difficulties which I'm facing is when this question that we ask to ourselves, that ask finding out who is having that particular sensation or the emotions or whatever the other things. So it is like naturally the mind is turned outwards towards the world, towards the emotion. I get the fact that it is told to us that the first thing is consciousness, which is looking at the other things. And we need to focus on the consciousness rather than what it is shedding the light on. But it is like it is like I'm a person looking at something where the light is put on that object, but I'm looking at the object. So mind is turned outward. So I'm facing this difficulty that how can I turn this and be with the self, where most of the day, most of the time, it is the mind and eyes are looking outwards to the things where it is shedding the light, not on itself. So this is the first question, Guruji. The second question was the state which we talk about, where we are living with that sense of understanding. So in that, we get the fact that the things which we are seeing, the people which I'm experiencing, this world in total, there is this light where it is coming from me and falling on them. So I'm seeing myself there. So I get this fact, but it kind of from like my, I feel like it is not so interesting. So it is like it is oneness, but I don't feel kind of interested in that oneness. I feel like I want multiple things. Let me taste, let me have an experience of different multiple things in the world. Like it could be sights, signs, taste, smell. So in this way, so I'm facing these two difficulties, Guruji.
Well, these are very interesting questions you have asked. You know, those who are on a very serious path of self-discovery will ask such questions, Rahul. So I want to just address this in a nutshell, and I'd be very happy at the next Zoom to delve deeper into this with you. But you see, there are two things here, Rahul. Sorry, I got to click on the mic. There are two things here. One is, it is all right to be in the practice of discovering the self or who am I of Bhagwan Ramana Maharshi's if one is in that environment where you can go within, focus within any thought which comes, to whom is the thought appearing, and so on. It all depends where you are placed in daily living. If you are engaged with the world, you know, Bhagwan himself, as an example, gave some such beautiful statements, like for those going to office or at work, he would just say, tell yourself, it is not you doing the work, but the current doing the work through you. So that again establishes the connection with the self only. So what I'd like to point here is that if you are doing this as a sadhana, as a practice, and yet you are someone who's very engaged in daily living, it is not going to be easy for you. And therefore, the self, you see, it's very clear, there's no selfhood apart from God. When we say that, it means any event, any happening in your life is not apart from that one self. So my request would be, if you can let me know in the next talk, whether you are referring only to this practice of abiding in the being, being in the self, understanding that, we then explore it only that way. My feeling is, if you are engaged in the world and are finding a way to navigate through the world while abiding in this teaching, then we will explore it from that angle. But these are two different things. So for example, if someone said they were going to an ashram for 3 months to look within and go within, I would speak in a different way to them. And if someone was deeply interested in the subject, but is engaged in daily living, has a job, has family, then that would be a different conversation. Otherwise, okay, there can be tremendous confusion.
Got it, Guruji. Okay.
Yes. Where are you based?
Currently, I am visiting my hometown. Otherwise, Mumbai still.
Oh, I see. Okay. Amchi Mumbai.
Yes, Guruji.
All right. So I think we will stop there since we've run out of time. And I'm just going to change the view so I can once again see all of y'all. I don't know where I found this poem in a very old book, maybe a 100-year-old book, just one extract of a poem, which reminded me of my Goraknath, the quotation of Goraknath's, which I'm most fond of, something in a similar vein. Well, that's the thing, when you want to find things, they are not, yeah, here it is. It's by a poet called Burroughs. I don't know if you all are familiar with Burroughs. I'm not. The name of it is Waiting. And this verse. Serene, I fold my hands and wait. Nor care for wind or tide or sea. I rave no more against time or fate. For lo, my own shall come to me. My own shall come to me. Sahaj mila so doodh barabar. What comes naturally? Unasked. My own shall come to me. And this passage of Joel Goldsmith sums up what we discussed today, where he says, this is the prayer of the recognition of the relationship between I, the Father, and I, the Son. We have no personal opinions because now the I that we are sees truly, sees no presence or power apart from God, hears no evil, knows no evil, and recognizes God. the divine consciousness, which is the selfhood of all being. So the quest for the self cannot be the quest for an object called the self. Thank you.